KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
906 949 KUOW. Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Asian Art Museum, presenting the Saturday University Lecture Series on Love, Loss, and Longing in Asian Literature and Arts, beginning February 15th at the Asian Art Museum in Volunteer Park. Tickets and information at seattleartmuseum.org/Gardner Center.
From KUOW 949 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. In 1931, Asotin, Washington Sheriff John Wormell was shot and killed by a 12-year-old boy. Herbert Nichols Jr. was almost hung by a lynch mob before he was sentenced to life in prison. Journalist Nancy Bartley reveals little-known facts about this story, including Nichols' troubled past and early Washington state history. Bartley is the author of The Boy Who Shot the Sheriff, The Redemption of Herbert Nichols Jr. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on January 7th, 2014.
It is an honor and a privilege to be here at Elliott Bay. When I was putting this book together and doing all the research, I mean, I just had this dream that someday it would come together, and all the hard work and all the trips to places like Asotin, Washington, and vacations that were spent gleaning the archives at the Asotin Museum and visiting cemeteries in Star, Idaho, and going to places like Dayton, Washington, and all these places that you don't generally spend your vacation would somehow pay off, and I ended up being able to do a reading at Elliott Bay because I had been to so many other readings here, and I always kind of felt that this was, you know, my favorite place, and this would be my idea of success would be to do a reading here. So it's really a pleasure to be here. So I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning of the book, of chapter one here. And then I welcome your questions. And this is a story that I'm obviously very passionate about because it's a true story of Herbert Nichols, who was 12. And I found it in the Washington State Archives, but we'll talk a little bit more about that later. Asotin, Washington, August 5th, 1931. Moonlight spilled over the banks of Asotin Creek where frogs chorused in deep pools. It was after midnight when he awoke cold and damp, unsure of his surroundings. This was not his grandmother's house, his grandmother with the big stick in the Bible. He had escaped. He was free and curled up in a hole along the bank. But unlike the small animal that had once made its home there, he shivered with cold. He was dressed in a thin shirt and worn overalls. His feet were bare, and he was hungry. He was always hungry. He felt the gun thud against his chest inside the bib of his overalls as he crawled up the bank. The frog stopped singing. He walked to the lumber yard and on toward the dairy, creeping about the sleeping town in the hope of finding something to eat. A car was parked alongside the road, and he sat on the running board, wondering what to do next. Then in the distance, he saw the gleam of a headlight. He darted into the shadows and hid behind a shed until the car passed and the chug of the engine faded. Earlier in the evening, he had hidden beneath the Asotin County Memorial Bridge as a family with 8 children picnicked nearby, the fragrance of their food filling the air. He had hoped to stay with Murphy Watkins, but Murphy's grandfather ordered him off the place. He left for a while and then returned. He didn't know where else to go. When the old man caught him a second time, the sheriff came. That's when he retreated to the only place he knew would be safe, the hole in the earth. Now it was dark and he was alone. The creek murmured as he crossed the bridge and walked toward town. He had never been alone in town at that hour of the night. Storefronts, the solitary courthouse, the square jail with its barred windows all cast shadows. Except for Anatone, 20 miles south, Asotin is the last pinprick of civilization on the southeasterly corner of the Washington state map. It is a small town where the Assotin Creek races east from the Blue Mountains to the Snake River. In the 1890s, it was the hub of commerce, situated on the route to the gold mines farther south along the Snake. Before that, it was the winter hunting ground for the Nez Perce. But in 1931, it was a town of ranchers and wheat farmers whose lives had been hard for decades. The Depression had brought nothing new. As the boy walked, he could feel the gun swing in the holster he had made from the leather top of an old boot by threading a belt through the loops and hanging it from his neck. He had taken the gun from Colonel Fulton's cellar while he and Fulton's son Jimmy were playing. Jimmy was only 10 and told him all about the guns the colonel had collected during the Philippine insurrection. But Jimmy was no doubt asleep in bed, and Junior, as Herbert Nichols was known then, was alone in town after midnight. With the gun, Junior felt powerful, like pretty boy Floyd, who robbed banks. He'd heard about the robberies on the radio as the hour of prayer slipped away to the news, and then he'd read about them in the Assotin Sentinel. As he walked from the park down the quiet streets, he knew that if his grandmother caught him, she would lock him in his room to pray for forgiveness, without food or water. Each time, the punishment was longer. But this time, he wasn't going back. He had made that decision when night fell and he wasn't home. She must have been furious to send the sheriff after him. This time, there would be no stopping her as she meted out the punishment of the Lord. He hadn't thought any further than the momentary desire to run down the hill and play on a sunny day. Now in the dark, he was approaching the lynching spot, the jail at the corner of Fillmore. How many men had died there? His grandmother said that's where he'd end up, a criminal. He'd always be haunted by her wrath and accusations. In the shadows of the building, the stream song was muffled. At Peter Klaus's People's Supply store, he saw cigarettes through the window. Cigarettes and whatever else he could find inside the store would comfort him on this cold summer night. The pavement was cold against his bare feet. He hadn't owned shoes since he first went to the state reform school 2 years earlier. He walked to the side of the building and peered into the store through the window next to the door. He turned the doorknob, but it was firmly locked. He slammed his frail shoulder into the door, but it wouldn't budge. Slowly, he walked back around the building. Across the street at the Assotin Hotel, a light the color of cherries gleamed over the desk. Junior walked around to the side of the store, took out the .32 caliber Ivor Johnston, and smashed it against the door. The glass tinkled like ice. He reached to the gaping window and unlocked the door. The store was cool and fragrant with tobacco and the tang of fat pickles swimming in the shadows of the vinegar barrel. Moonlight streamed in through the broken panes, and he could see the rack of tobacco, candy bar, and gum. First, he opened the cash register, pulling down the heavy lever and watching as the numbers popped up and the drawer flew open with a zing. He scooped out $2.82 and put it in his pocket. Then he snapped open a paper bag, as he had seen the Klauses do many times before, even the day before when he had bought shells and charged them to his grandmother's account. Into the bag went Lucky Strike's and Adam's gun. His plan was to return to the stream, feast on gum and candy and smoke. When morning came, he would meet Murphy, and they'd go fishing or shoot jacksnipes up by Henley's old place. Maybe he would hide out there, living off fish and stealing watermelons from the farm up the road and fruit from the orchards. He knew he would have to lie low until his grandmother stopped looking for him. She would pray for his black soul, pray that he not be cast into the fiery depth of hell for his sins. He had done a lot in his 12 years. He had stolen everything from cars to candy. Perhaps that's why his mother got rid of him and all the other boys. Like most children, he blamed himself for not being forced to live with his grandmother. He wondered if his mother ever thought of him. Hazel Nichols' face had become blurred with time and tears. Someday he would return home to her with plenty of money and be able to buy her things so she wouldn't have to work so hard, so she wouldn't have to give all her children away just so they could be fed. That's what his mother had said the day the social worker came, which was not long after the police had arrived and arrested his father. He wondered why they hadn't come for his father earlier. He could remember that day hiding in the barn while his father looked for him, carrying a shotgun. Over and over, his father shouted his name. "Who dared bring that dog home?" Bert Nichols had screamed. "Who dared bring that barking dog here?" It was forbidden. His brother had tied the puppy up to the porch, and it whimpered loudly. Over and over, his father yelled for him, "Junior! Junior!" And finally found him in the barn, pointed the shotgun at him, and asked him if he had brought the puppy home. "No, not me, Papa," he said. He could see his brother Wesley's horrified face in the yard beyond, pleading with him wordlessly not to implicate him. "Not me." Lying came easily when it was the only way to survive. His father had lowered the shotgun and walked slowly from the barn. Junior's brother was trying to untie the dog, but his trembling fingers wouldn't move fast enough. Junior heard his father laugh, heard Wesley cry out as the dog began to frantically bark. Bert Nichols raised the shotgun to his shoulder and aimed at the puppy's small brown head. Then he pulled the trigger. As Junior was filling the bag in the dark, he suddenly became aware of three shadows by the front door. There was the murmur of deep voices. He dropped the sack and scurried softly to the back of the store, slipping behind a vinegar barrel and a pile of boxes next to a roll-top desk. Then the front door rattled and the door swung open, the little bell jingling. "Come on out." It was John Wormill, the sheriff of Assotin County. Inside the store, there was nothing but silence. "Come on out now." Again, there was no answer. The sheriff repeated the words once more and cocked the hammer on his revolver. He nodded to Charlie Carlisle, deputy and county clerk, and Peter Klaus, the grocer. Then he and Klaus stepped inside. Peeping over the rim of the barrel, the boy could see the sheriff silhouetted in the moonlight and the glint of light on the gun. The man moved closer. "Come out before someone gets hurt." The sheriff's voice was calm. After serving four terms as sheriff and about as many as deputy sheriff, he knew that patience paid off. Suddenly, the store's lights came on, and the boy ducked, blinking in the harsh light and fumbling to remove the pearl-handled revolver from the holster. Listening closely, he could hear two, maybe three sets of footsteps. Deputy Sheriff Wayne Bazzona stood inside the side door near the broken glass as the sheriff and the grocer walked slowly up the aisles. Klaus saw the bag the boy had dropped and stopped to retrieve the items as the sheriff crossed the room. Listening for the softest flutter of sound, he had walked almost the entire length of the store with his gun in his hand and was standing close to the vinegar barrel when he heard a familiar click and a roar. Both Klaus and Bazzona heard the blast from the gun, saw the sheriff spin and pitch forward as if still walking, and they ducked for cover. But who had shot him and from where? There was no smoke from a gun. Bazzona ran out into the street to the hotel where a man had stumbled outside after hearing the shot. Bazzona told him that the sheriff had been shot and yelled for the doctor and then ran back inside the store with Carlisle. In the silent room, he could hear his heart and the ragged edge of his breath. Across the store, his eyes met those of the others. Where was the shooter? He took a step forward, kicking a cardboard box out of his way and shouted for the shooter to surrender. He heard the sound. A scurry, a faint rustle of paper. He trained his revolver in the area of the desk. Where was he? There was no place big enough to hide a man. He took another step forward and kicked another box out of the way, keeping his gun trained on the sight. No one behind the molasses barrel, no one behind the vinegar barrel. Where had he gone? Had he slipped down the cellar steps a few feet away? He hoped not, as it would be even more dangerous to hunt for him among the crates in the dim light of the bare electric bulb. Then Bazzona saw a small corner of faded denim near the back of the roll-top desk, but no one could possibly hide in the few inches that separated the desk and the wall, unless the person was very small. Again he ordered him out. Bazzona could hear the shouts and tire screeches outside in the street as others came to help. He tried not to look at Johnny, lying so still on the floor. 73 years old, John Wormill should have retired long ago. Bazzona had tried to tell him that. Come on out or I'll kill you. His voice boomed through the store, but there was no reply. Minutes passed, and then, as Bazzona trained his gun in the area of the desk, the boy threw a revolver over the top. Bazzona kicked it to the other side of the store, keeping his own gun trained on the desk and waiting to see what madman would emerge from the shadows to own the deed. Bazzona ordered him to raise his hands and come out. It seemed like forever before two small hands appeared from behind the desk, then the frail arms. In the end, a boy less than 5 feet tall stood up and looked nervously around, his face white, his body trembling. Bazzona rushed forward and grabbed him. The deputy's face was red and close to the boy's as he gripped the boy's shoulders. What did you do this for? The answer to the question would be published in newspapers everywhere. I was told to, the boy cried. He had recocked the gun and was ready to shoot Bazzona when surrendering seemed to be the better idea. The body of the sheriff lay face down on the floor, a bullet hole just above the right ear. Everywhere there were spatters of blood like drops of dark rain. Rain, that's what the Nichols children would remember about that day long ago when they came home from school and pushed open the gate to find a woman lying in the yard with a bullet hole in her back, a farmer shouting, the sheriff's siren wailing, their mother screaming. Their father's face was bloated and red as he chased her. She carried a baby boy in her arms as she fled into the fields. The neighbors stood stunned in their sun-bleached front yards, except for the dead woman's family who had gathered around the still form. She was a gentle soul, a Quaker. Why kill such a kind woman? She gave her life to protect another, they said. Why did you do it? A police officer had asked his father as the sheriff handcuffed him and led him to the squad car. Why did you do it? Bazzona asked the boy again. The doctor arrived and was kneeling beside the sheriff. Men and women in their nightclothes, having been roused from sleep at the hotel across the street, gathered to peer in the windows. Even in the pre-dawn hours, the boy knew they were angry and speaking of lynching and punishment. And what a good man poor Johnny Wormill had been. Poor Johnny, slain by Mary Addington's juvenile delinquent grandson. Johnny, who had never had a chance to protect himself. Too bad Johnny hadn't gotten in a shot. What a blight Mrs. Addington had brought on the town when she let the boy stay. Tears began flowing down the boy's cheeks. I was told to. Bill Robinson put me up to it, he said. Robinson. The boy said that Robinson had waited at the side door while he went in and got tobacco and money. He planned to give the boy $2 and a ticket to Canada for his trouble. Bazzona told the boy, took the boy to the sheriff's office in the courthouse, telling Carlisle to summon Halsey, the coroner, and Merchant, the undertaker. Bill Hostetler, the part-time deputy night clerk who worked as a state brand inspector day by day, also arrived on the scene and stared in disbelief at the prone body of the sheriff. The ticking of the regulator on the office wall echoed through the quiet building. It was almost 1 a.m., and the boy was very tired. Bazzona asked him to tell him how the shooting occurred. The boy had only been in town since May, and he'd been nothing but trouble to his grandmother. Once again, the boy repeated the story. Bazzona sat behind the desk. The boy was sprawled across two polished oak chairs and seemed to be slowly melting into them as he sunk into the realm of sleep. He was small for a 12-year-old, 60 pounds, 4 feet, 8 inches. Too much food creates a rebellious spirit, his grandmother believed, and she locked her pantry. With each infraction of her rules, she gave him less. It was God's will, she said, taking her seat in the rocker by the oil stove. She would purse her lips and read the Bible in the halo of lamplight. He would wait until she fell asleep and try to take her key. The dark streets bustled with the chug of automobiles, the flurry of whispered urgency. Bazzona rose from his desk and nodded to Hostetler, instructing him to stay with the boy, who was sleeping stretched across the oak chairs. In the meantime, Dr. John McIlvain stood at the entrance of the store, looking weary. Elmer Halsey had just arrived. The three men entered the store where the sheriff's body lay. Nothing could be done. The sheriff had been killed instantly, McIlvain said. The bullet went right into the brain. Elmer Halsey had seen crime in the many years he had spent in Assotin. A rape back in 1896, a murder in 1903, bank robbers, horse thieves, cattle rustlers. Sheriff Johnny Wormell always neatly wrapped up the cases. He'd served his town well. A fine man he was, a devoted community servant, a state representative, and a charter member of the Annatone Odd Fellows. Halsey knew someone would have to tell Annie Wormell. It would be a hard job. Halsey was not only the prosecutor, he was also the elected coroner. Filling in as sheriff if the current sheriff was unable to serve was just part of the job. Halsey, well into his 70s, was grim about the prospects. He never thought he'd be writing up the death certificate for Johnny, but Bazzona knew he would have to be the one to break the news to Annie. He walked slowly from the store, vowing that Robinson would pay for putting the boy up to this. Even though it was still several hours before dawn, word of the shooting had spread. Men milled about the courthouse, talking in low tones. Bazzona asked Carlisle to round up some men to go out to the Robinson place and arrest Bill, but Carlisle looked puzzled. Old Bill Robinson? Put the boy up to it. Bazzona told him to take several other men with him, cautioning them to be careful, because if Robinson was capable of this, he was capable of anything. The new Ford V8 with the red lights hummed along the road to where Bill Robinson lived with his daughter Della Watkins, her husband Jim, and their seven children. Young Murphy Watkins was jarred from sleep by the barking dog, the roar of the car engine, and the winking of its red lights. He rose on one elbow and looked across the screen porch where his mother and sister also slept. His mother quickly rose, wrapped a bathrobe around her. The dark shapes of the lawmen came to the screen door, and their fists pounded on the frame. Open up, Robinson. They had come to arrest him, and Della ran to the door to block their path. They pushed her aside. She asked what they wanted with her father, but they shoved past her to the door to the bedroom where Robinson was still sleeping. They demanded he get up and get dressed because he was being arrested. What? You want to arrest me? The old man said, sitting up in bed, startled. For the murder of Sheriff John Wormell. Murder? The sheriff? Murphy's little sister, Jean, ran past the man and threw herself at her grandfather, crying. She clung to the lawman, pleading for her grandfather's release as they led him from the house. Please don't take him. He didn't do anything bad. Don't take him away. Murphy and Jean followed the men into the yard, watching the deputies handcuff their grandfather, saw him duck his head to get into the back seat of the patrol car. The dry grass hissed against the lawman's boots. Car doors slammed, the engine again came to life, and the lights streaked red against the backdrop of night. Jean and Murphy stood in the yard. The soft dust, so hot against their feet during the day, was now cool. Jean whimpered softly and ran to cling to her mother. The car traveled down the ribbon of road, its red lights winking until at last there was nothing but darkness and a scattering of stars. Della told her children to return to bed, that the arrest had been a misunderstanding and it would be straightened out in the morning. But when she tucked them in, Murphy noticed that she was fully dressed. Shortly afterward, he heard the screen door squeak open and softly close, and the engine of his grandfather's truck came to life. In the distance, a coyote yipped, but there was no return chorus, only darkness. Murphy would say years later that his world changed that night. No longer would his world revolve around games of marbles and kick the can and mumbly peg, or paste and blackboards, or the white starched shirts for Sunday school. All that had existed, the humming, contented, familiar melody of his childhood, had vanished. His world was now uncertain, a place where anything could and had happened. It was a dark, silent emptiness.
Nancy Bartley, the author of The Boy Who Shot the Sheriff, The Redemption of Herbert Nichols, Jr. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on January 7th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at @KUOWSpeakers. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Nancy Bartley in a moment, 931, 94.9 KUOW. New research based on 25 years of data concludes routine mammograms do not reduce a woman's chance of dying of breast cancer. Later tonight, a conversation about risks and benefits of regular mammograms. That's at midnight. A vocal group of parents, teachers, and doctors are pushing Seattle Public Schools to start school later in the day for middle and high school students. Studies show teenagers' biological clocks make it hard for them to get a full night's sleep when school starts much earlier than 9 a.m. But most middle and high schools in Seattle start at 8 o'clock or earlier. The school board's considering the change, but says it could be hard on many students' work and athletic schedules. A report tomorrow morning in the 8 o'clock hour. Forecast says lows around 40 tonight, breezy, rain developing late this evening. Friday highs near 50, breezy, rain at times in the morning, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers in the afternoon. KUOW and Auburn Symphony Orchestra present Musical Gems, a concert featuring Dvorak Symphony No. 7 and Weber's Clarinet Concerto No. 2, February 15th and 16th at the Auburn Performing Arts Center. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
KUOW and Book It Repertory Theater present the adaptation of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein or The Modern Prometheus, the science fiction tale that asks, who is the monster, Victor Frankenstein or his creature? Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. The year, 1931. The place, Asotin, a small town in the southeast corner of Washington. A 12-year-old boy named Herbert Nichols Jr. shoots and kills the sheriff. After evading a mob who threatens to hang him, Nichols is sentenced to life in prison. But his story doesn't end there. Seattle Times reporter Nancy Bartley conducted extensive research on Nichols for her new book. It's called The Boy Who Shot the Sheriff: The Redemption of Herbert Nichols Jr. Bartley spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on January 7th, 2014. Next, she takes questions from the audience. Some of the questions are a little quiet, but she does repeat them. The first question is, did Nichols have any living relatives that you talked to?
Yes, I certainly did. All this is from his relatives. She asked if Herbert Nichols had living relatives that I talked to. When I began the research, he had a number of living relatives, his brothers, and then over time, before the book was actually came out, some of his brothers had died. And he has a son who's still alive and well and, you know, has been very, very helpful, especially in the latter part of the book. He was very, very, very instrumental in making it come to life. Anyone else? Yeah.
What was the point at which you knew that you had a whole book on your hands?
What was the point I knew I had a whole book as opposed to like a news story or something? Well, the whole thing started out, as you know, I'm a reporter for the Seattle Times, and it started out when I was wondering who was the youngest person to have faced the death penalty. So I went down to Olympia to the state archives, and I was poking around, and I found a story about a 17-year-old boy who had been executed. And then while I was there, someone says, do you know about this 12-year-old? And I thought they meant a 12-year-old who had been executed, but they said, no, this 12-year-old was given a life sentence for murder. And so they got a few documents out, and that, I thought, well, this is really interesting. So I started doing a little more research, and then I found out that one of the news stories had mentioned Father Flanagan of Boys Town in Omaha, who, of course, was very, very famous in the 1930s because he had the philosophy, there's no such thing as a bad boy. Well, he factored very heavily in this case. And so I thought, well, I'm going to write to Boys Town, right? I'll call Boys Town and see if they knew anything, you know, have any information. So I called there and I talked to their archivist, and at that time they said, well, you know, we're not really sure, it's been a long time, and, you know, and I'll look around and see what I could find. And I kind of forgot about it, and I thought, okay, well, that's that. Then 6 months later, in the mail, I got this large box. I mean, it was just a very, very large, and it was stuffed full with Flanagan's original correspondence, on that case. And that's when I knew it was definitely a book, because this was so much more than just an isolated few weeks that he'd been involved with. This became one of the most frustrating cases of Flanagan's career, where he did everything he could to free Nichols and just constantly was running up against conflict with Governor Hartley of Washington and battle after battle. And all these other people got involved too, including Will Rogers got involved. It was just astounding to me how much support this one 12-year-old had for getting him out of the prison. It was, even at that time, it was pretty outlandish to send a 12-year-old into a state maximum security penitentiary. Other questions? Yeah.
Did you ever feel like your journalistic instincts were at odds with your narrative instincts?
Oh, it was my. Was there a contrast between journalistic instincts and the narrative instincts? I had to always be very mindful of that. So, in fact, there were many, many drafts of this book. And one was way too narrative, one was then way too full of attributions, which bogged it down. So in the final draft that you see here, all the attributions are in the back and sourced in notes, which makes it much more, it'll flow smoother, yet at the same time it gives it the journalistic standards of being able to back everything up through fact. And in cases where I, tell what's kind of in his head, I got that from interviews with brothers, letters. There were a lot of letters. He had written quite a few letters. The more I dug, the more I would find. So that there was quite a bit of material that I could draw from. So, yeah.
Newspapers around the country pick up this.
Oh.
Shooting.
Yes. Did any other newspapers around the country pick up the story of the shooting when it first happened? Yes. Not only around the country, but around the world. It was an enormous case. From the smallest paper in Wisconsin to papers in New York. I found all kinds of news clippings, and I ended up with my own file system that I devoted one room of my house to doing nothing but stacking, clippings from these different papers and sorting them into, this pertains to Flanagan, this pertains to Nichols from 31 to 33, and, Nichols 34 to whatever. But there was many, many clippings, and each one, so some of them, of course, were kind of the same because they were covered by a wire service, but sometimes they'd have something that was totally different, especially when the Los Angeles Times had some, and they would have, they would actually send a reporter to a Sotin and cover something. So, as they might do now. Other questions? Yeah. Why did he get such a harsh sentence? Well, I think part of it was that, John Wormell was a beloved member of the community. He was 73 years old, and he was absolutely beloved. And then Herbert Nichols was a menace. He was in trouble constantly. He might have been just 12, but nevertheless, he had already stolen a car. He had done all kinds of stuff, and he'd only been in the town for just a few months, and he was just, stealing and lying and just causing all kinds of problems for people. And I think they had just had it with him. There's a part in the book here early on is that one of the people who was a candidate for the U.S. Supreme Court actually said that he believed that Nichols should have been hanged, that he would always be a menace to society, that a life sentence was not severe enough. He should have actually been hanged. And there was discussion about that. The jury could have come back in his case and elected to have, you know, that was an option for them. Instead, they decided to send him to prison. Did my feelings about young offenders change as a result of the research and the treatment of him? I think it had to. I spent so much time and so many years on this that I had to draw a parallel between, where my own son was at 12, and he came along on some of the research trips, and he was riding his bike in the dirt outside the museum at the time, and I was thinking, well, if he had picked up a gun that was, had access to and accidentally fired it, you know, or fired it in self-preservation, kids do impulsive things that are not smart. And so, I mean, to an extent, yeah, it absolutely did. Sending him to the penitentiary there was clearly, it worked out really well for him, but it only worked out because of the pressure, you know, Flanagan put on the state of Washington and on the penitentiary. I mean, it was an extraordinary circumstance, but, it's never an ideal situation, without a doubt. Yet I do think that there's probably a model in it in terms of, I think, what he needed clearly was, food, shelter, structure, someone to care about him, personal attention, education, all those things he managed to get in prison, and, you know, freedom from abuse. And sadly enough, he was not getting that outside the prison environment.
Nancy Bartley, the author of The Boy Who Shot the Sheriff, The Redemption of Herbert Nichols, Jr. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on January 7th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at KUOW Speakers. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Nancy Bartley in a moment. 945, 94.9 KUOW. Gilda, Otto, and Leo are three young expatriates entangled in a symbiotic love affair. But as emotional allegiances shift among them, they learn that the only certainty they share is change itself. Design for Living by Noel Coward in an LA Theater Works production tomorrow evening at 10. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows around 40, breezy, rain developing late this evening. Friday's prediction, highs near 50, breezy, rain at times in the morning, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers in the afternoon. Grammy-winning singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash and her husband and co-writer John Leventhal talk with Michael Feinstein about their work and perform music from their latest album, The River and the Thread, beginning in a few minutes at 10 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from Swedish, announcing the opening of their health insurance information desk for those who have questions about which new health plans in Washington include Swedish in their provider networks. More information at swedish.org. Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Mark Morris Dance Group, performing Love Song Waltzes, along with two Seattle premieres, New Love Song Waltzes and Socrates, February 14th through the 16th at the Paramount Theater. More information at stgpresents.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. In the 1930s, a 12-year-old boy shot and killed the sheriff of Asotin, Washington, a tiny town in the southeast corner of the state. The crime stunned the town and the nation. The boy, Herbert Nichols Jr., was sentenced to life in prison. This story was lost in the state's archives until recently. Seattle Times reporter Nancy Bartley dug it up to give insight into the history of criminal justice. Nichols had a fascinating life, even in prison. People wrote letters to the governor asking him to free the boy. During a deadly prison riot in 1934, several inmates kept Nichols safe. And when Nichols got out of prison early, he went to work at 20th Century Fox in Hollywood, keeping his past secret for the rest of his life. Nancy Bartley's book is called The Boy Who Shot the Sheriff, The Redemption of Herbert Nichols Jr. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on January 7th, 2014. Next, she continues to take questions from the audience. Some of the questions are asked off mic, but Bartley does repeat them. The next question is, does your book say something about Washington State as a place?
I don't know that it says it about it right now, but I think it does, as it was in the 1930s. I think it was a very harsh place, although I don't know that it was all that unique. I think there are many states that were quite harsh at that time. The 1930s was the harshest time in it came to capital punishment. More people were put to death in the 1930s than any other time in U.S. history. And, of course, we were in the middle of the Depression. And it's just, so I think that there was a lot to do with, it was just a very, very harsh, harsh time then. And Washington State was not the exception. One of the things, of course, that you asked the question too about, narrative and versus, journalism is that a lot of the information also came from these news articles, and including small details like detail in here is that the Methodist Church there was selling fried chicken dinners. And I love that kind of detail because, it added so much to it. But I found that in a news story, and just by pawing through all these volumes and volumes of news stories, at the time. And, if you're interested in doing historical research for any kind of narrative work, it's really... something to really think about is really carefully going through these old documents, all these old news stories, because they really are quite valuable for that kind of little detail. Okay? Yeah?
So how long did it take you to
do? Well, the book had many, many lives. Like I said, many, many revisions, because I started it when my son was 12. He's now 31. I really do write much faster than that, but... I would say if I really was going to boil it down, I probably would have spent several years just researching. If I was doing it full time, it would have been maybe 2 years of full time research. That wasn't the case because I never took a leave of absence to do it. So I was spending all my vacations researching. Yeah, and so I wasn't able to spend full time at it. It was just, 4 weeks here, 4 weeks there, and weekends and things like that. Yeah.
Were there any other works that had been done that were a model for you or helpful?
Not one in particular, but clearly many other narratives that I just really enjoy, whether it's any of Eric Larson's or Praying for Sheetrock, Melissa Faye Green. You know, any of those are just really fine narrative journalism, you know, and I just really, you know, enjoy that style. I mean, it's just fine storytelling. Yes. Okay, why was the story so compelling to me? I think because, you know, when on that first day when I saw the picture, it's the picture of the little kid on the front, you know, and I just saw that, and it was on a card the size of a recipe card, and I thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. WSP 13973 with a chain around his neck, that's his prison number. And he looks like maybe he's 8, but in reality, of course, he was 12, and I just thought, oh my gosh, this shouldn't happen. You know, that's not to say he didn't do something really bad, because he did, and it's not to say he wasn't a problem, because he was, you know, but I just thought to myself, this shouldn't happen. And I feel very strongly that kids deserve better. They deserve better homes than he had. You couldn't have got a home that was much worse than he had. You know, he, you know, was battered, he starved, he, you know, he had no one to care or love him. So it's a miracle that he came out as well as he did. You know, it is a success story. So, yes? Did he end up dying in prison? I can't give you the ending of it, but it does have a happy ending. It has a happy ending. I'll guarantee you, it has a very happy ending. It's going to really surprise you. Yeah. And let's say it has a Hollywood ending. It does. Literally a Hollywood ending. He doesn't end up, he gets out, I'll tell you that. And then something very exciting happens to him. So, yeah, anyway, that you'll never guess. So.
But he was a person of extraordinary intellect.
Yes, and that is one thing that he really had in his favor. I mean, he was really a very bright, bright boy, and he had a real desire to please, you know, because he'd never had any real love or time or attention, and all of a sudden, you know, he found mentors that were, I mean, very positive mentors in that prison library, people who would encourage him to read, encourage his education. So he read all the books in the prison library, and then he actually graduated from Walla Walla High School without ever having set foot in the high school. And they gave him lessons through what was then Washington State, it was then Washington State College. Yeah, Cougarville. You know, I'm a Husky. I guess I can't really say that word, but anyway. Yeah, anyway. So they even brought in, you know, he even had college in prison because he was just so bright, and he ended up teaching others in prison when he was a teenager. So, you know, they put him to work at teaching others. So, you know, yeah.
Boy, and what has his life? Do you give any thought at all to the charge you impose this sentence on him? Did prejudice the was the judge re-elected? Was he? Was he put out of board in office? So what happened to him?
Oh, Judge Kuykendall was just, you know, continued on. There was nothing that I know was... He ended up being a very esteemed, you know, continued on as being a very highly regarded judge, and there wasn't anything that was ever really came down. I mean, he had a bunch of letters, definitely, you know, around the country, but it, you know... So he never lost any elections or anything like that, and he retired from the bench and wrote his memoir, I think it was the southwestern or southeastern Washington, something like that. And he mentioned.
This is an activation of the Amber Alert system. We have just received this important information regarding an abducted child in Everett, Washington, Snohomish County. The Everett Police Department, Snohomish County, is looking for a child who was last seen at Everett, Washington, as believed to be in danger. The child's name is John Turner. He is a 17-day-old infant male child. Authorities say that the child may be in the company of Rochelle Turner. She is a 31-year-old Caucasian female with black hair and brown eyes. She is believed to be 5 feet 5 inches, weighing 190 pounds. The description of the vehicle is unknown at this time. If you have any information on the whereabouts of this child, please call 911 or contact 425-407-3970 immediately.
Everyone, I enjoyed this opportunity to tell you about my book. Thanks.
Nancy Bartley, the author of The Boy Who Shot the Sheriff, The Redemption of Herbert Nichols, Jr. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on January 7th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to KUOW.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at KUOW Speakers. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
I shot the sheriff, but I swear it was in self-defense. I shot the sheriff, and they say it is a capital offense. Sheriff John Brown always hated me for what?
Support for KUOW comes from Pacific Continental Bank, working to strengthen communities by helping businesses and nonprofits succeed. Learn more at therightbank.com. Pacific Continental Bank, focused on business, passionate about community. KUOW and the Museum of History and Industry present the new exhibit, Revealing Queer, opening February 14th, exploring 40 years of LGBTQ history in the Puget Sound area. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org. Less than a minute before 10 o'clock, KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Tomorrow morning, a review of the week's news, including what could be a long delay in construction of the tunnel under downtown Seattle, and Governor Inslee calling a halt to executions. Tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Lows around 40 tonight, breezy, rain developing late this evening. Friday highs near 50, breezy, rain at times in the morning, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers in the afternoon. KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington. Thanks for being a member.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.